For as long as I have been a Unitarian Universalist, that is, since my childhood in the 1960s, this faith tradition that I belong to has been trying to grapple with racism that it, and that is, we, have been swimming in. Unitarianism and Universalism have been part and parcel of white supremacist culture in which they developed. For all of the 200 to 250 years that these two American religions have been in existence, we have been predominantly white, mostly Northern European, well-educated, and comfortably well-off economically. Our history includes preventing African Americans and other people of color and indigenous people, women, differently abled people, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people from becoming clergy and denominational leaders. Yes, UUs were abolitionists, but our people also included pro-slavery members and clergy, especially in the South. Yes, we were at the forefront of the fight for LGB and later T rights, often leading the way ahead of or alongside the progressive wings of other denominations and traditions. But congregations are still biased towards straight, white, cisgendered, able-bodied ministers in the search process, particularly male. Yes, UUs were marching for civil rights next to black leaders, and some, like Viola Liuzzo and Reverend James Reed, were even killed because of this solidarity. But in the late 1960s and early 1970s, we majority white UUs balked mightily when African American UUs asked to be recognized, to be empowered, and to receive funding to build UUism in non-white spaces. That history is usually referred to as the empowerment controversy. It's a whole other sermon. It rent the fabric of our UU pride in being leaders in the fight for racial equality. About a quarter of a century later, UUs were invited to address this long smoldering and toxic history through a denomination-wide program called the Journey Toward Wholeness, a few years after a disturbingly short-sighted and hurtful General Assembly programming snafu, and I am using snafu as it was originally created. Do I need to spell it out for you? Situation normal, all effed up. A program that showed once again that we UUs are so steeped in white supremacy culture that the GA Planning Committee couldn't see beyond its noses. They held a Thomas Jefferson ball to which GA attendees were invited to come in period costume. It sounds funny, but it was very hurtful and painful. This was in Charlotte, North Carolina in 1993. Not really any different than last year's revelations, I might add, of our elected leaders in Virginia wearing blackface as young adult men. The Journey Toward Wholeness program fell far short of its aspirations. So it is not surprising that 2.5 years ago, the Unitarian Universalist Association was rocked by an employment discrimination complaint during the hiring process for the Southern Regional Lead position. Resignations of key leaders, including President Peter Morales, reverberated throughout that spring. It has been a disheartening time in the life of our denomination. Love is a core teaching and practice of UUism, and there have been times when that love seems pretty thin. In the words of current UUA President the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. This is why it can be so painful, even faith-shaking, when our institutions or our leaders fall short of love, where we reinforce domination, exclusion, or oppression, when we act as a mask instead of a mirror for our freest, fullest selves. To be a faith of action with love as our doctrine doesn't mean we live it perfectly, but it does mean we are called again and again to learn, to make amends, to restore relationship, to choose love. I believe that as painful and challenging as it is this time, we Unitarian Universalists are taking the issue of systemic racism and our complicity in white supremacist culture very seriously. It isn't without argument, believe me. If you had access to the minister's Facebook groups, oh my God. And there's stuff out there than in the lay world of Unitarian Universalism too. It isn't easy. Examining our personal participation in systemic oppression is uncomfortable. But we can't claim being anti-racist if we don't root out how our own lives contribute to keeping the culture of white supremacy alive and fully functioning. Why are we talking about white supremacy? Crystal Fleming, author of How to Be Less Stupid About Race, uses critical race theory to explode the myth of colorblindness and the baloney of so-called post-racial propaganda that claims any of us whites are beyond race or non-racist. Whites in this country have always been favored economically, politically, and socially. Critical race theorists such as Charles Mills convincingly argue that the maintenance of white supremacy involves and requires cognitive dysfunctions and warped representations of the social world that conveniently serve the interests of the majority population. I would love to say I'm beyond race, that I'm non-racist, but I know that's not true. No, I don't intend to be racist, but racism was all around me as a child. It's still all around me. It's around all of us. As a young person, newly independent through the privilege of a driver's license, I cringed when my grandparents would comment about making sure that I locked the car doors as I drove through a predominantly black neighborhood on my way to their home in an affluent one. But 4 decades later, I felt personal embarrassment at unthinking comments on 2 different occasions that have stuck with me. One was to a dear friend of mine, a lesbian African American with Native American heritage from New Orleans. I said that I didn't see or think of her as black, and I quickly realized how dismissive that was of her full identity. And the other time that especially sticks in my memory was when I was boarding a flight. My seat was in the rear of the plane, and as I approached it, out of my mouth came a comment to the African-American flight attendant about sitting in the back of the bus. Gasp. Seriously. How could I say such a thing? Using the metaphor was painful to me, whether she actually heard me or not. What I do know is that I can be a good person and still be unconscious of my own racism. Katie Waldman's July 2018 article, A Sociologist Examines the White Fragility That Prevents White Americans from Confronting Racism, addresses this common misconception. The most effective adaptation of racism over time, Robin DiAngelo claims, is the idea that racism is conscious bias held by mean people. Conscious bias held by mean people. I don't see any mean people out there. And I know I'm not mean. But I am unconscious. She goes on, this good-bad binary positing a world of evil racists and compassionate non-racists is itself a racist construct, eliding systemic injustice and imbuing racism with such shattering moral meaning that white people, especially progressives, cannot hear or cannot bear to face their collusion in it. She says, pause on that, white reader. You may have subconsciously developed your strong negative feelings about racism in order to escape having to dismantle it. Cognitive dysfunction. I am no different than any of my white co-religionists here this morning. My life has been shaped by and I have benefited from the systems of white supremacist culture. Yes, I belong to some identity groups that are marginalized and oppressed, but I cannot know what it is like to be on the receiving end of either intentional or unintentional acts of racism. I don't know what it is like to be denied overtly or covertly access to employment, education, housing, medical care, and so forth because of the color of my skin. I don't have to live in fear of how I will be treated by law enforcement, or whether people are going to assume the worst about me, or, in the words of our story this morning, to walk into a courtroom full of foxes as a goose. I also understand that taking responsibility for my own racism is a revolutionary act. I invite all of us white people to learn and reflect on these issues of white privilege. I encourage each of us to accept the invitation to examine ourselves for the racial bias that we have been infected by and benefit from. You can read any of the increasing number of books on the subject. I'm not going to take time to name titles. They're out there. Look in the UU World or on Beacon Press website for great titles. Self-study through reading is a good place to begin. After this beginning, however, it will be important to be in conversation with others. We need each other to do this work together. We need to support and challenge each other to become our best selves. We can't do this revolutionary work alone. So, there's an opportunity for group reflection coming up here at Brew. Bev Reusser and Deborah Buckingham are facilitating White Fragility, Let's Talk About Racism on three Sundays, starting next week and continuing on the first and second Sundays of November. The discussion sessions are built around Robin DiAngelo's New York Times best-selling book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, that was published by Beacon Press. There are three copies of the book circulating here at Brew. You can pick one up from the mailbox in the office, labeled Fragility, sign it out, and return it there for someone else to read. Or you can get your own copy. Writing in the foreword to DiAngelo's White Fragility, Michael Eric Dyson says, white fragility is a truly generative idea. It is a crucial concept that inspires us to think more deeply about how white folk understand their whiteness and react defensively to being called to account for how that whiteness has gone under the radar of race for far too long. DiAngelo makes it clear that racism is a structure, not an event. As an international superpower, the United States has circulated white supremacy globally, promoting it as an ideal. Because white supremacy is never named, it has been invisible, unlike other political systems such as capitalism, fascism, and socialism. Not naming white supremacy and not examining how its culture is mediated by race makes white fragility possible. White fragility manifests when white people's racism is called out. It could be called out by a person of color or by a white ally. It presents as responses in the form of argumentation, silence, and withdrawal. Defensiveness, deflection, and redirection are common tactics. The emotions displayed by fragile whites include anger, fear, guilt, grief, and tears. Each of these functions to bully the person who has named the racism present into submission. White fragility is a form of white racial control. During the ALE class, you will engage in facing white supremacy, learn how race shapes the lives of white people, and gain tools for interrupting racist patterns in your life and in our social systems. In other words, you will be working towards the goals that Chris Crass speaks about in this morning's reading: to destroy white supremacy and end structural oppression, to affirm humanity by creating and welcoming healing communities, to nourish liberation values and raise freedom fighters, and to all get free together. Chris Crass is a leading white male activist UU who supports people working for racial justice. In fact, in your order of service, you'll find that you're invited to learn from Chris at the Fairfax UU congregation in an all-day workshop on Saturday, November 9th, called Beyond White Fragility: Courage for Racial Justice and Collective Liberation. I encourage you to take advantage of the programming that our neighboring UU congregations offer. One of our staunchest allies for racial equity, or ARE, Carolina Krawarik Graham, wrote about white supremacy culture and why she uses those words. She explains, "A common issue in anti-racism work is the use of the term culture of white supremacy or white supremacy culture, which many people view as charged, controversial, or even deeply offensive. Sometimes there are even challenges, dismissals from people in positions of power and authority about it. For me," Carolina says, "use of the term is a necessity for these reasons. Because it's used commonly by many prominent writers and speakers on the subject of race and privilege, and one cannot actively pursue this work without coming across it. Because it is very uncomfortable for me to read, write, say, white supremacy culture on so many different levels, not the least of which has to do with sensitivities around my own national cultural heritage. So it's my way of directly challenging my own right to comfort. 3, because when this term is used by someone from the dominant group, in this case white, it is a very different experience, generally less antagonizing and a bit more difficult to dismiss than when it comes from someone who's marginalized, in this case someone of color. And it is a way that I exercise my privilege toward laying groundwork for others' voices. And lastly, because I have been asked to use these words by people in oppressed communities, both directly and indirectly, because white supremacy culture most accurately and succinctly describes the or their harsh experience of systemic discrimination. It is one of the ways in which I express my allyship." I find myself on the same page as Carolina in my use of the words white supremacist culture and similar phrases. Elizabeth Nguyen reminds us that the Unitarian Universalist feminist and peace activist Margaret Moseley called social justice work moving mountains one stone at a time. We move mountains one stone at a time. As Unitarian Universalists, our journey is to transform the big and the small, to transform ourselves and to transform the world. In a world without end, may it be so. Will you join with me for some pastoral prayer? Our lives hold so much, so very much. We go from tears to laughter, from sorrow to joy, and back again. We recognize and grieve and send out healing energy to those in our midst, those to whom we are connected through friendship and family or mere acquaintance, to celebrate, to support, and to be a loving human community, in fact, a beloved community that cherishes each and every life. Blessed be. Amen. Namaste. If those around you are welcome to holding hands, you may reach out and hold hands with those nearby. As we say our chalice extinguishing words, we extinguish this chalice, for the worship has ended. Our service begins.